Yeah.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I really wish the sun, the sun's coming out, finally. It's freezing outside, but when you read this, you're going to get warm and toasty. This is a really cool novel, and we have a great author here. We're going to talk to the author of Snifter of Death. But let me warn you people, the next time you decide to take a drink, make sure you poured it in. You didn't leave it anywhere for anybody else, and don't walk into a room and just take a drink. You never know what could happen. So, in this, yeah, I know. I looked up Snifter. I go, oh, my God. Young kids need to know that when you go to a bar and you have a drink and you're leaving it, throw it out and get another one. You never know. So by the summer of 1889 was proving to be a strange one for Detective Inspector Rudyard Bloodstone and his partner. That a sexual pervert loose, the man didn't actually harm women. This was hilarious. I mean, really, this was really so original. But threatened them at knife point, fondling them, and ultimately stealing their stockings. Your stockings are expensive. That's not right. So far more serious were the murders of influential men. But I'm not going to tell you any more because author Chris Carson is here, and she's going to tell you all about the dangers of a snifter of death. So can you tell us, give us a brief summary of the novel and how you created Bloodstone? He's a cool character.
Well, I'm a retired detective, and I kept hearing from people, you know, why am I going to run a cop story? And I didn't want to relive my career on the page. And so, and there's so many wonderful contemporary cops, Joe Wambaugh and Mike Connolly write great cops. But I love history. My father was a history professor, so it was just part of my life. And I just thought, you know, I started thinking about it. And I had to do a trial scene for another series, for another book, where the girl was at medieval times, and she was bringing forth her case before the king, and she's a London attorney. And I said, you know, this kind of stirred her memories up, and I said, well, you know, maybe I could do a detective, but I want to put him in a different time period. And I don't think, to me, London has got just the greatest atmosphere for murder, Victorian London with its fog and the cobblestone streets and the big black carriages, and the East End was so terrible, and, you know, it just had such a variety of great setting to place something. It's almost a character of its own. So Bloodstone was my guy, and I have always been interested in the Zulu Wars. And I went to Brecon, Wales years ago and had a personal little tour with a docent of their regimental museum. And I said, you know, if I ever write a book, I'm going to have the protagonist. It's going to be a veteran of this particular these particular battles. And so that's it. I made him, he was in the service military for a few years and got out. But he won the Victoria Cross, but he never thinks of himself as a hero. He puts that, it's in the drawer by his socks. You know, he just does what he does. And I try to write him with humor, because, you know, and the stocking guy, the stocking thief was a wonderful little subplot that let me have him play around with the guys he works with, you know, like cops do. And then the main plot was the murders of these influential men, the poisoning of these men, because he and his partner just keep running into dead ends because they can't see what the connection is to the victims.
Well, we have this other guy. This was really got me. I mean, I've read, I can't even tell you, thousands of murder mysteries, but the stockings was hilarious. And of course, getting the guys to dress up, that was even more hilarious too. So how did his rivalry start with Napier, and why did he want to fight him? And instead of dealing with the issue of stocking stealer, he was more interested in the boxing match. That was really
clever. That actually kind of goes back a little bit to book one. I don't go into a lot of detail on what started the rivalry, other than you know that Napier dislikes him intensely. And I always I have Ruddy's partner say, you know, the thing, he's jealous of you. He's jealous of you because you have that Victoria Cross, and, you know, people are curious about it, and people respect it. And it was the highest, just like the Medal of Honor at the time. And Napier is just, he's kind of like, you know, he's just one of these small-minded people, a petty jealousy. But he is the boxing champion of that particular department. So, you know, he's... there's always this ongoing, you know, back and forth between him and Napier. And in the first book, you know, he was supposed to work with Napier on a case, and he kind of cut him out of the case. This guy's going to make a cake out of this. He said, just, we'll tell him later. Well, you know, we'll do what we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been this back and forth between them. And so when he, and Ruddy knows it's coming. Ruddy knows the day's coming, the day of reckoning, when they're going to have to duke it out. And so, yeah, so Napier, this is his bailiwick, is doing it the proper way in a boxing ring, because that's the way he's been training on, you know, his off hours. And Rudyard is nothing but a street fighter. So he knows he can get, even though he's a strong, tall guy, he knows that this guy knows the Queen, you know, Marcus of Queensbury rules, and he can probably beat the snot out of him if he's not careful, because he knows the rules, and he knows how to play that game. So that's why Reddy goes into training with that broken down fighter.
Well, you created the first scene, and the thing is that this took place in 1889. So it's kind of different from a murder mystery in 2017 or 2018. So what techniques and forms of information did they have back then that they don't have now? And they didn't have DNA back then, so they had to be a little bit more resourceful. So what forensic help did they have back then? I mean, I know they had some type of fingerprinting.
Yeah, they didn't have fingerprinting.
Fingerprinting didn't even come about.
Until the late 1890s, and then it wasn't used a lot. It wasn't really reliable yet, so it wasn't employed a lot. Scotland Yard did it occasionally, but it was still a new science for them. He has no science, and that was what was so interesting with working with him.
Mm-hmm.
He has to everything he knows from a crime scene. He takes from walking that crime scene what he can ascertain from the way the body is, from the wounds, from the environment around the scene, and then what witness statements are. And so as a detective myself, so I had, you know, I'm writing him, I have to walk the crime scene with him. And I have to remember, I have no, you know, I was lucky enough that I always had science available to me, crime labs and stuff. So now I'm walking this old-fashioned, you know, detective work the old-fashioned way with him. And, yeah, it was there were times I sat back and looked at the monitor and go, okay, what can he take from this scene? And the two, it was like I was his shadow going, okay, well, he can see this, he can see that. But, yeah, the only thing I give him, he has a young constable that is that photographs the crime scenes for him, which they did do that. And he has, you know, they do have a medical examiner that can say this is what the cause of death was. And he does, they are able to determine that it was arsenic was the poison. They can determine what kind of poison was used from examining the remnants of the cognac. But as far as, like, blood work and fingerprinting and any other kind of sophisticated DNA, or, you know, for them, sophisticated DNA that didn't exist yet.
No, that's scary. But yet they managed to get the job done sometimes better than the people today with all the technology. You just never know. So how did you create the first set of crime scenes dealing with the person? I was hysterical laughing. I'd go, like, this guy's stealing people's stockings? Is he for real? Why a person with a stocking fetish? And how did you come up with this kind of crime? Because I thought that was really clever. And I've read, like I said, thousands of books, and this is a first. Seriously a first.
Well, I spent 25 years in law enforcement, and some of those years were in Chicago, and so but most of them were in the Los Angeles area.
Mm.
And it's very hard to work in an urban area and not run into almost every kind of pervert there is. So I didn't want to do a rape, you know, I just didn't want to do that. So I wanted to make this guy, you know, just weird little perverted guy. And I thought, well, you know, and these guys, there's all kinds of guys out there. They got shoe fetishes and foot fetishes. And there's so many, you know, guys that want to, people that are out there in L.A. or and all over that. They have little clubs there. They dress up like big furry animals and stuff. I think they're called Furbies or something. I mean, there's, you name it, it's out there. So I just thought, you know, here's something. It allows, it's a little bit of relief. takes my foot off the throat of the reader a little bit, because I give them a little, try to give them a, something a little lighter and to amuse them. And because this guy is a little nutso, and he's not hurting the women. You know, he's scaring them, but he's not hurting them. And the women will get upset because, you know, for these working girls and working women in those times, because jobs were hard to find, and, you know, they didn't make a lot of money, so stockings were expensive. Mm. And that probably upsets them just almost as much as the knife being wielded at them. Because, like, I think the girl says, those were brand-new stockings. You know?
I know. I mean, if you've ever worn nylons, I mean, everybody wears knee-highs or whatever, and you wear the long pantyhose, but if you ever wore nylons and they rip, you want to scream. And because they were so expensive, and the littlest run says, oh my God, it cost me $10 for that brand new pair of whatever. Back then my mother would say, oh my God, it cost me forever, I don't want to wear them unless I have to wear them, and who wants to replace them? And they stole the good hose. So the comical scene, and I could picture it in my mind, was how did you create the scenes with the poor police officers that had to wear these things and get dressed up and do this thing? That, I mean, I could picture this. Oh, my God. And anybody else would have just said, I'm quite quit. I'm not doing that. How come they had to do that? And what? How did you come up with that?
Well,
that's
part of their
job.
I mean, when we had certain crimes, especially sex crimes, that's not unusual. That you set up a sting where you have people undercover that are, like, if you had a crime, let's say, on the subway, that you know you have a series of crimes and it's happening, let's say, on the, you know, on the Kennedy Expressway or something ill. So you start doing plainclothes cops and setting it up. Now, we, modern day, since from, you know, at least the mid-1970s, you had women that could do this, female officers. But now, there were no female officers in those days. So you had to find some two young constables that could, from a distance at least, pass for you know, women. That's their job. Their job is to try and catch this guy. And so when the superintendent says, no, you guys, I'm picking you guys, and you guys are going to do it, well, that's your job. You know.
Oh my God! I don't know. It's that must have been the most embarrassing. And then they would come complaining because they wanted to make sure that the right person fit them for the dress, and they wanted somebody to make sure, one of the police officers' wives, to make the dresses for them. And that was like, oh my God, that was hilarious. So how did Ruddy and Archie get out of doing it? How did they manage not to have to do it with these two guys?
Well, Archie's a little older than Ruddy, and Archie has big mutton chop, you know, big mutton chop sideburns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he isn't built very well for a woman. He's a little shorter and he's stockier. And even though he plays rugby once a month, I think I even mentioned in the book, he still, you know, he has to watch his, you know, he still has a tendency to be on the stout, a little on the stout side. Ruddy, I described even in the both in this book and in the first book, is Ruddy's tall. He's tall and on the lean side, but still well built. Just like his brother, in the first book he explains that he was underage when he went into the British military because he looked older because he was so tall. But I picture him, he's probably about 6'2", which is tall for those days. And, you know, a short little weirdo isn't going to attack a woman that's 6'2". And first of all, it'd be difficult to, you know, find a woman in London in 1889 who was 6'2", you know.
Oh, my God.
So they picked two youngest-looking constables with very little beards and, you know, pink cheeks and said, okay, you know, but put a bonnet on them and a dress and send them out.
I hope they had the good makeup and lipstick and, you know, good hairdo, too, while they're at it. Oh, my God. So who is the head of this thing was Jameson. Every time they react, why is he supportive? Does he help them?
It's both. Like with many superintendents or supervisors that I've had over the years, he's generally supportive, and generally, you know, they get along with him. He's generally supportive, but you know, when they start hitting, a lot of times when supervisors start hitting that lieutenant and above level, you know, when they start getting to be captains and assistant chiefs and stuff, they become a political animal, and they're not going to they're not going to jeopardize. They most of them. Let's put it that way. Most of them are not going to go to bat for an officer. You know, necessarily if it means that, you know, is politically going to hurt him, hurt the supervisor, and that's just the politics of police work, of law enforcement. I mean, you know, you hit the captain level, they want to move up. And Jameson's he's a superintendent, and he, you know, he's in London, the Parliament, London, you know, the House of Lords and House of Commons. Those men, they wielded a lot of power over the law enforcement agencies, the two agencies that work London, City of London Police Agency and Metropolitan, which where Reddy works. Parliament rule, you know, when they come in, and you know, it's politics now. I mean, if you get cities where the mayor or somebody or somebody high up says, you know, I want you to investigate, drop what you're doing, investigate this now, or, you know, I mean, it's politics or politics. And Jameson still has to play that game.
Oh, wow. Now we come to a very interesting figure in this story, Graziella. Who works at Mrs. Zachary. I'm not going to say too much about her, but she was this was so clever. So she's working for this lady. She's supposed to do certain tasks. So how come she believes her? Because she's not doing half of what she says she's supposed to do. This girl was very clever. Scary.
But she actually is. Mrs. Zachary, this is not an uncommon job for women in uh-huh. Victorian time period, being a lady's companion. Most of the times you were a companion to older women who were widowed. You travel with them. You play cards with them, that sort of thing. Keep them company in general. But you're really not, truly part of their social circle. You're not part of the family. You're still a staff member, but you're not staff in the way that the staff welcomes you. You're kind of in that nether world. And that's why she could sneak up Mrs. Zachary. Took naps every afternoon, so there was a couple afternoons where she could sneak out. She got a half day off every week, when she got to go and work with, learn how to you know, do some of the stuff she had to do. But she wouldn't jeopardize her job. So she was still at no point was she not doing what Mrs. Zachary wanted. If Mrs. Zachary needed her to do something, she did it. Like, oh, I'm going to go to the doctor. I want you to accompany me, or I'm going to go and let's go to tea. Then she would have gone to tea, you know.
Well, Graciela, what is her reason for being there? Why did she want to work for her?
Because it's a job. Jobs were hard to come
just
by for women
job,
in those that period. You had, if you were talented, like the one lady, the one victim of the stocking guy, she's an embroiderer, and so she works for a popular haberdasher. So you can be a seamstress, you can be an embroiderer, you can work for a milliner. You could be a governess. Some people, if you were educated enough, or you can be a ladies' companion. Their jobs were few and far between for women that those days. They weren't allowed to do a lot of things. So when she left her small little village and came to London, like many people do come to the city for work. People here leave small towns to come to Chicago and New York and L.A. look for work. Same thing then, and, you know, she left a village, and she went to get a job in London, and this is her job. And I mean, she's just looking to make a living. And she has room and board in a nice area of town.
That makes it even better,
working for Zachary.
Well, we've got this guy that named Addy. And he's wanting the killer, but we won't say who the killer is, that she better be careful. And he doesn't want to know, but he's teaching the person how to pick locks and staking out a mark. So you must have used your own career to teach Addie how to do that, or to teach the killer how to do that. So how do you stake out a mark?
Well, I think I set it up with her, where she kind of watched, and she was managed to sneak out of Zachary's house and kind of watched and to see what their routine was. And that's with a lot of these guys. They look for the routine. I mean, you're always going to get the random opportunist. That's most of your crimes are crimes of opportunity. But with something like this, where she was determined, she had a specific victim in mind, she knew what she wanted to do. So then you look for the routine. We look for the way in, in their by using their routine, and that's what she did. And Addie, you know, he's still a crook, and he'll work with her and stuff. But in a way, he can see he can see that she could come to a bad end because she is not really never been part of the criminal world until now. But she doesn't want to listen, so he said, "Okay, I'll show you what you want to know, but be careful."
God. So what happened to her when she was 14, that she decided that she's going to take revenge? And then there's three guys that get killed, Cross, Skinner, and Finch. Why them?
Because there were four guys. She didn't get to the fourth victim. Those four guys were a part of the rowing team, Oxford rowing team. And she was at 14 when they had a pass. They walked by leaving the school, the university there. She was walking along the riverbank collecting flowers. She was 14. And the first guy, Cross, who was kind of the leader of the pack, they decided to go down and harass her. And the harassment turned to rape. And, they took turns holding her down and then laughed about it, you know, and she was only 14. And when she said to them, you know, "I'm going to go to the police" or whatever, and Cross turned to her and he said, "Who do you think they're going to believe? We're from foreign influential families, and you're just some little village bumpkin, you know. They're not, so go ahead, go to the police." And that's the way it would have gone in those days. The class system was so ingrained in that Victorian society that probably, let's put it this way, nobody can say for sure, but the odds were they wouldn't look at these young men from Oxford very hard, you know, that they would probably, because their fathers, their families were wealthy, and they were going to Oxford, and she was nothing. She was just this little village bumpkin, you know.
I wonder today, though.
I mean,
do they
rich
look
men
at people
still
the same
get away
way
with stuff.
You
look
I know
at that kid
get away
last
with
year
stuff
from
today,
Stanford that raped that girl. He what did he get? He got 4 months. So, in some ways, nothing's changed, and the police did go after him.
Look at the news today. I know.
Yeah.
There was another one this morning on a radio show that got fired for the same thing. This strange-looking guy.
This is incredible.
I mean, and then Matt Lauer, and then Harvey Weinstein started it, and I'm saying, my God, this book fits right in there. Maybe people need to take a closer look, and then there are a lot of people that are afraid to come forward. And, yeah, it's horrible. So how she rationalizes her actions. Well, you could sort of understand how she feels, you know. After all, you did this to me, I'm going to get you. So how does she manage to succeed the first two times? I thought that was brilliant, by the way. The snifter is a great weapon.
I should qualify when I say, you know, she didn't want to talk to the police about it, because there is that scene where she does have a conversation with Rudyard, and he's talking. He says, you know, when you take revenge, when you act on your own, you know, he said it's almost always going to end badly. And she says, but you know, would the law have helped me? And he said, well, we'll never know now, do we? You know. And Rudyard is very, you know, he's a very stand-up guy when it comes to the law. I mean, this is a man that probably would have at least tried to investigate this crime. But, you know, that's hindsight for her. And I don't like to write slasher books. I don't like slasher murders. I mean, I just don't like to read them.
Yeah.
I don't like to watch it on TV. And what was a woman's weapon? And to me, a good woman's weapon, because, you know, stabbing somebody, that's close in. You got to get close in, and be easy for her to get overpowered. The gun thing, she doesn't really think about guns too much in the beginning, because that's just very removed from that society, and certainly from women in those days. So, you know, it's just not something that pops into her head immediately. And so I'm thinking, like, what is available to a woman that she can do? And, she picks arsenic. Maybe she researches four different kinds of poison, and she chooses arsenic because it's odorless, tasteless, You know, it can pass, and not a lot of times, arsenic poisoning can pass for food poisoning. It has similar symptoms. But so I had to set it up that the people around these victims understood that this wasn't what happened, but that something was going on other than wasn't food poisoning, in other words. And then she started watching those victims, looking for their routine, looking for where was the break in their routine that she could ingratiate herself or insert herself into their lives or in such a way as to taint the cognac or whatever they were drinking.
Well, we have another character that I thought was really cool, and Ruddy is a really cool character. So how come he hooked up with this name is too cool, Honeysuckle Flowers? And what does she do? I said, oh, my God, she sounds like something belongs in tea, like you pour it in tea. And so why doesn't it bother him what she does? And how come you paired him up with her? I thought that was really good, because most police officers wouldn't go with someone like Honeysuckle Flowers.
Well, he's always been, even in book one, he's always been a fan of music hall. And she's, you know, a singer and dancer in a music hall. They're a very... the Odeon actually existed in those times, and it was a really very popular, very large music hall. So she's doing quite well as an entertainer. And he is not. Rudyard's family originally in the story. He's being from Brecon, Wales. His father's. He's got there are 10 kids in his family. His father's a farrier, you know, he's a horseshoer. So he comes from kind of very, very poor background. And so he doesn't put on airs, he doesn't have that class structure thing is not part of his world and never has been. And so, to him, he likes music hall, and when he meets her and she's pretty, and he enjoys her personality. She's bubbly, and it's just like he says, he just doesn't judge her. He just doesn't have that judgmental streak regarding her. There is even that comment in there. He said he never wants to know who she was ever with before. It doesn't matter to him. And just like he would never. It doesn't matter who he was with. It's just we're here right now, you and I.
I just wonder how many people would really feel like that. I don't know. That's a hard one. That's what makes him like stand out. So when the first two men are killed, and they investigate the murders, why does Cross's main butler think it's poison? They don't believe it. So how does the Emmy identify it? And why did it take him no time to learn what was in the drink, even though it was back then?
Yeah,
he be able to do that? Yeah, that's pretty fast.
Oh, yeah, well, you can test. They could test for poisons and stuff, and they had that ability because there's, first of all, he tested the stomach contents of the victim, and which they did have that ability, because he's still a pathologist. And they can test. There's chemical tests that even in those days they could do to see whether it was belladonna or arsenic. But he would have gone. He would have checked for arsenic first once he did the autopsy, and saw the arsenic got to him. And the butler says there's just he's lived with this. He's been with part of this family. His father was part of this family as a butler. And he says there's something wrong here. And as you said. As you know from the story, Rudyard and his partner are kind of like, they don't believe him. They said, there's no indication here this is murder. And the guy says, he didn't eat anything bad that upset us. Everything he ate, we ate in the staff. So we would all be poisonous. Not that. Look at the circumstance here and the way he is. He didn't drink himself to death. He's just, he just knows that there's something in the man's routine that's not right. And that's why he says, this is a suspicious death. And that's how the call came in, was a suspicious death. And Rudyard and Archie, his partner, kind of, they just want to blow it off because they just figure, come on. And it's not till they get the autopsy report back that they realize, oh, this is a murder. Well, damn. Better do something about it.
Well, then we meet two very interesting characters. And this was very clever because Graziella is sneaky and very clever. And when she wants to kill, you know, when anybody wants to kill somebody, they have to figure out a way to do it so they figure they don't get caught. So then we meet Nurse Keating and Fitch. And what red flags go up and what do we need to learn about them?
Yeah, Fitch, she didn't expect the Nurse Keating part. And that was a surprise to her, if you remember.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, because she was afraid. She wasn't looking to kill an innocent person. And she was a little afraid that Nurse Keating might, you know, wind up taking a tainted drink.
Mm-hmm.
But she took the chance anyway because it was her one and only way into Finch. And she also recognized Keating and Finch had a more than a professional relationship. And she tried to give, you know, she tried to give Finch, he was the only one she actually, of the three that she tried to give a chance to, because when they said he volunteers at the you know, pauper's hospital for women on the East End, she thought, well, if he's come around and he's become a good man and he's doing this wonderful thing for these poor women, and it's a woman and children's hospital that did exist, in East London, and it's for the destitute. And when she went in, and if you recall, when she went in and started talking, then she finds, that's when she learns, she learns from the one woman. She says, yeah, but he forces himself on him, on several of the prettier women. And she says, ah, so you haven't come around. You're still the same, you know, horrible man that you always were. So I am. I'm going to proceed with poisoning you.
Mm. Well, I just want you to know before I forget, with my glasses, Cheryl's listening from Partners in Crime. And for those of you that want to do a great blog tour, I wouldn't go with anybody but them. And they just did mine for my new book, A Daughter's Promise, with Providence Books. And I am very proud to say that I got some great reviews. And I'm also very proud to say that my cover won Best Cover for 2017. I'm excited. Didn't expect that, and it's really great. So thanks to Cheryl and Wendy and Gina for taking care of all of us. They're fantastic. You don't want to go with anybody else. So
I'm very happy
back.
With Cheryl, with Partners in Crime. Very happy. And again, congratulations on your cover.
I'm excited because my publisher, Edit Prose, entered it, and I didn't know. And then they sent me this thing that I was a finalist. And then I sneakily looked at the thing and I go, I cremated. It was a landslide. I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, my God, I really won this thing. And my mom's on the front, so she would be proud because she's the one that I honored in the book. So then we got Graziella. Why in heaven blazes did she decide that she wanted to become a volunteer at the hospital? And then she meets this woman, and then her attitude changes. Says, yeah, now I'm right to do what I want to do.
She never really intended to be a volunteer. She was just using that as a ruse to go in and kind of find out what was going on with Finch. She never really intended to be a volunteer. She doesn't.
Yeah,
it's
I
not
didn't
her
think
personality.
So.
And she couldn't break away that much anyway from Zachary. No, it was just a way to walk around and talk to people, and you know, that was just a cover up for her.
So why did you create that surprise for her when she learns the truth behind her attempted third murder? What happens then?
That's the doctor, Dr. Finch.
Yeah.
I wanted to. Each man had to have. For me, I wanted each man to have something,
mm-hmm.
some little thing that was different. That you know. So you have the attorney, and I wanted to throw in his male secretary because that was always. He always presented a problem for Graziella. And so there was always some twist in their personality or some obstacle to give her that was just more than just walking into their office and dumping a vial of poison in their drinks. It, you know, I have to add some color to it.
Well, if you don't, then it gets boring. But since there's no obstacles, it becomes too easy. So before I forget, Wednesday, we have one of my favorite authors in the whole universe. John Land will be here with Strong to the Bone and the Caitlin Strong series. If you've never read it, you got to read them. They're fantastic. On the 11th, I am totally honored. D.P. Lyle, who is a consultant for Criminal Minds and CSI, will be here with his new book, A-List. And on the 12th, FBI agent Michael Tabman and I are going to talk about what's happening in the news. We're going to talk about safety in schools, safety in hotels, and what people need to look out for when they are on vacation at the airports, and just basically why we need metal detectors in the school and a lot more, and whatever else we come up with. The 14th, one of my other favorite authors that deals with partners in crime, Bruce Coffin, Beneath the Depths. And on the 19th, I've got Reese Hirsch, Surveillance. And to round out the month, Jawad Jamarini, his new book, Joshua's Journey. Should be interesting. And I start next year on January 4th with an interview with Pastor Michael Jones. This was an original book. I didn't think I was going to read it, but I did. How to Be a Seventh-day Adventist. And I learned a lot about people and how you deal with people. And Michael is going to be on the show for the first time. He agreed to do an interview and talk about working with the homeless. So that should be interesting. So now we come back to the fun part of the book, the match. When we have, what blackmail does Napier use against Ruddy to make sure he fights? And what's the wager? That was so good.
Yeah, well, the wager would have been basically we knew that it was a matter of pride for both of them. Rudyard is like, I'm never going to hear the end of it. This guy wins this fight. I'm just never ever going to hear the end of it. And they knew the men from each of their station houses were betting. You know, there were heavy bets there.
Yeah,
and which is another thing that Ruddy would have said. You know, he would have had every detective he worked with going, I lost $20 on you. You know. But Napier has that pornography, well, for those days, what was considered pornography, which by today's standards were like very, you know, pretty easy stuff. But for those days, he had a collection of artsy look pornography. And one of them was a picture of Honeysuckle. She's very, very young, which I mentioned in there. When Ruddy sees the picture, she's very young. You know, she's like maybe 15, maybe 16. And it was taken in, it was done, the sketch was, the photograph, because they had photography. The photograph was done in France because he could see the Notre Dame through the window behind her in that picture. And it was an artsy one because they had draped a diaphanous material over her and stuff. And but it still would have been scandalous if Napier turned it over to the press, because she was, you know, a big music hall person, well-known in the music hall world. And he didn't want that. He wanted to protect her from that. And Napier said, you know, if you win, it's yours. If you lose, it's mine. I'm keeping it. And you don't know, you'll never know if I'm going to use it or not. And so that was the wager. And then, you know, Rudyard is... The thing with Rudyard is he says, is this the only one out there? And that's the one where Napier said, I don't know. It's the only one I have.
I know. That was some fight, though. My God. So tell us about Tony, who trained Ruddy. And what happens when Honeysuckle, that's, I love that name, wants to attend the fight? He doesn't really want it to. How come?
Well, he's afraid if he loses. He doesn't want to lose in front of her.
Yeah.
And he knows he stands a good chance of losing because this is not the type of fight he's used to. And plus, it's a rowdy group. It's a typical, you know, in those days, you know, nowadays people go to Las Vegas and women in diamonds watch fights. But in those days, women didn't really, well, women that were, you know, I mean, the East End women in poorer classes did watch these little back room fights, but I mean, women with some decency didn't go to fights, you know. So he didn't want her exposed to these guys, you know, that attend these boxing matches and stuff. But mostly, he didn't want to lose in front of her. The one reporter finds Tony, and he sees that Tony was once a boxer, and he can, you know, he knows how to, and he does spar. That's part of his job. He spars with guys at this one gymnasium. And so when he tells Ruddy, he says, this guy might be able to be helpful. You could use the money probably. And when Ruddy sees that this guy is really down and out, he hasn't got, you know, he's poor as a church mouse. And the one thing about Ruddy was, you know, which I really wanted to do with him was when he was walking, they made the arrangement, he'd come in early morning and this guy would work with him and spar with him, teach him some of the rules. When he saw that the guy had a medal, his medal from the Afghanistan war, there was a 300-mile march that the British Army made from Kabul to Kandahar, which was incredible and brutal and everything. And Ruddy, having survived an incredible battle at Rourke's Drift, when he sees that medal and knows what this guy went through, he wanted to help him. He's a veteran, and he wanted to help another veteran.
So tell us more about Mrs. Zachary. And what happens when she's enlightened about Graziella? That must have been, that was a rough one.
Yeah, I didn't really go down that road too much. I mean, she would be, you know,
yeah.
She would obviously be shocked, and she would dismiss, you know, she couldn't stand up to any kind of scandal. I mean, she was a well-to-do woman. But I really didn't want to go down that road too much with her because she wasn't that important as a character. Because you never really see her much on the page. She's mostly by reference.
Well, the killer, whatever, seems to feel justified, and she justifies herself to the police. I mean, these people did this to me, so I'm getting even. Is that what people actually, when you interrogate them? Well, he did this to me. He stole my money, so I have to kill him. I mean, I've read so many books that it just sounds like, yeah, he did this to me, I'm going to get him. And is that what people actually say? They justify their actions,
there are
and
some
they think
people.
They're going to get away with it, right?
Yeah, not everybody, but there are, you run into all sorts of people that give you a reason why they're doing what they're doing. People can give you all kinds of reasons to justify their actions. There are those who feel like, you know, I'm right, I was in the right, and I just took the law in my own hands because of X, Y, and Z, you know, whatever it is that they did. There are people that are just... there are a lot of people out there, not a lot, but there's a fair number of people out there who are amoral. They don't, you know, there's their sense of right and wrong, there's no moral core to them. And they, you know, they do what they do because it seems exciting to them, or the person irritated them in that moment, and they just do awful things. People, as many people as there are in the world, those of them are people that will come up with a reason for why they did what they did.
Wow. You know what? I'm sitting here writing. I take notes when I do this. I get creative here. And I've done quite a few panel shows. And the last panel show I did was with Michael Tabman, the FBI agent, D.P. Lyle, because he writes for Criminal Minds, Bruce Coffin, because he's a detective in Chicago, and a lawyer, Larry Thompson, and we talked about how you present cases in a book, and how do you present the forensics, and how do you do this. So I'm thinking maybe in February, since you write about the past, I would be interested to see how cases, how a murder case would be presented with forensics and everything in the past as opposed to the present. I think people that are writing novels need to know the difference of how to write them and how to present the cases, because I've read so many that are wrong, seriously. So I might contact you to do something like that in February, because I think that would be interesting. You know, how you do your research,
sure.
And how you know this is interesting to me. My niece wants to go into forensic psychiatry, and I'm excited because she's 15. She just got a letter from Harvard to look at her. And from Villanova, she's that smart. So these are the type of things that I said to her, you know, I need to have you have contact with people that would, you know, be in that type of field, so she'll understand it. So if Graziella could speak to you, the reader, or the author, what would she say was her motive, and why does she feel that, you know, what would she tell you about, you know, missing out on one more murder? Poor thing.
If she would probably say, I'm only sorry that she doesn't regret a single thing that she did. And that's why when she has that conversation mm-hmm. with Ruddy and towards the end, mm-hmm. she doesn't regret it. She says, I feel justified. The law wouldn't have helped me. This, he was absolutely, Cross was right. They would have taken their side. And so when I saw him again, and what they did was inexcusable, and so they needed to pay for that. And as far as the fourth guy, had they gotten into that end of the conversation, which I cut it off because mm-hmm. of, well, you know what happened with her, she would have said, I regret that. I just regret not being able to get out to get to him. But he lives outside the city, and it would have taken me some time getting away from Zachary. That would be the only regret she had, just that she didn't get to him. But she felt like I have to do this because the law won't help mm-hmm. me, and what they did hurt me, and they laughed about it.
Well, there are people today that think the same way, and she did not. She had no remorse whatsoever. That's what made her such a great character, is that I did this, I don't care, and I have no remorse. It's like, a kid who somebody steals from them, I'm going to steal right back from you, and if you don't like it, it's just too bad. So do you think Mrs. Zachary would keep her? Or would she try, if she had a chance, Graciela, that she would turn to something else so that she can continue her streak of murder?
Her streak would have ended with the fourth guy. But mm-hmm. once the police contacted Mrs. Zachary, Mrs. Zachary would have fired her, would have sacked her, because she doesn't want even the hint mm-hmm. of scandal. And if the police are looking at some employee, a staff member of hers, that smacks of scandal in some way, she would have dismissed her. There would have been, she wouldn't even ask her about it. She wouldn't even talk to her about it. I mean, because that's how the upper class was. I mean, she would have. Mm. There would have been no thought on Zachary's part that this woman has no livelihood or anything like that. It would just been, the police were here. They had questions about you. You need to go.
And she wouldn't go after Mrs. Zachary to kill her, would she? If she knows too much about her?
No, she wasn't that. She wasn't, as she said a couple of times, she said, I'm not a murderer. I just uh-huh. murder people that I have cause to.
I sort of like her attitude. Seriously. What can I say? So what is next for Rudyard? And will his romance with Honeysuckle continue? Because that was like one of the highlights of my book, of my reading. It was so good.
Well, I'm writing, I have another series that's called Nights in Time, and it's a historical romance series with a time travel element. So I'm working on book 5 for that right now. And then afterwards, book 3 for Rudyard. I don't know yet what I want to do with him plot-wise, but I want to bring his brother back, Will.
Oh, good.
I liked Will. He was fun. And, yes, Honeysuckle will come back. His relationship with her, I was happy with his relationship with her, and I thought she was a fun lady to write because she, for the period, for the time frame, she was independent enough and she spoke her mind enough mm-hmm. that she was a little bit stronger and more willing to shift. She was clever about something. She wasn't afraid to show it for a Victorian lady. She wasn't all about like wearing corsets and fainting or something,
This is my kind of person because I wouldn't wear them either. My mother made me wear them. I had to wear the big crinolines when I was growing up. And I go like, Ma, I weigh a ton. I don't anymore. I weigh a ton. You're making me look even tonnier. I don't know. It's even big now. Girls, kids wear crinolines. And I go like, why? They're so uncomfortable. So what about Archie? Are you going to bring him back? Are they going to work side by side?
Yeah,
is he going to have more conflicts with Napier? Because that sort of brought that was a good point in the book.
Archie will come back because Archie's his regular partner. Archie was in book 1. He's in book 2. I like Archie because Rudyard has Rudyard has a quick temper and it can get him into trouble because he can be very sarcastic with that quick temper and Archie's a good foil for him because Archie can pull him back. Archie's able to talk to him sometimes and pull him back so he doesn't get in too bad of trouble with his mouth and his temper,
Mm-hmm.
And Archie's just such a, he's just up to the polar opposite. You know, he's got that, he's been married for a long time, and he's got the two little girls, and, you know, he's the stabilizing force there for in that partnership. He's a real stabilizing force. So, yeah, I'll bring him back. Napier, yeah, I'd like to have Napier come back. I haven't decided what I'll do with him yet, but, yeah, because Napier is just a running thing. You know, this is something that, you know, if they think of their jurisdiction, something happened that's out of their jurisdiction that may have happened in the city's jurisdiction, he's always going to run into Napier. So that's going to be, you know, maybe they'll have a rematch. I haven't decided yet.
Well, if anybody wants to know what to buy, that's nice. I just got an email from author Alex Gray about I was going to check out everybody to buy Pound of Flesh. Her book is fantastic, and she loves my review. That's all that really matters. Yay.
Yeah.
All her books are great. And if you didn't read The Swedish Girl, that's what I'm reading now. The problem is that I can't put it down. Your book, A Snifter of Death, is great. Everybody, Hanukkah's coming, Christmas, Kwanzaa, or any holiday, New Year's Day, anything. Buy a whole bunch of books, because that's the best present in the world. So Snifter of Death is fantastic, and Strong to the Bone is Caitlin Strong, John Land. Pound of Flesh is fantastic. Pre-order Swedish Girl. I'm in a thing called Limitless. It's an anthology for the charity from McGrath House, and the proceeds go to helping people in the Middle East, and I'm very proud. On page 48, my poem is there, I Love You, Mom, Now and For Always. And I was allowed to put my views on Amazon because it was just my views. It wasn't considered a review, so I was really glad to do that. Also coming up, and I'm not going to tell you who's going to get this, since I have a sanctioned site, as everybody knows, that Just Reviews is mine, and MJ Magazine is mine, MJ Magazine and Just Reviews will pick their 10 top books of the year and present the awards to the authors on Facebook and on my site, and they will be getting an email with this beautiful award as soon as my publisher makes them, because if I make them, they won't come out as beautiful as they did last year. So I have to decide. Yeah, I do this, and then I shock people, and then I shock myself. So where can everyone find out more about you and your work and your career in law enforcement, and what that helped writing this novel? This is one of my favorites, and as Cheryl knows, I get eye strain when I sit up and pick up a book like yours and just sit down and read it and don't put it down. Seriously.
I'm available on all the e-sites. I have Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Smashwords, iBooks. Snifter just came out in audio form on audible.com. And I have my website, chriscarlson.com, has excerpts from my other books. I don't know if I have an assistant that helps me. I don't know if she's posted the excerpt yet from Snifter, but I'll have her do that, you know, within the next week or so. And all the trailers for the books are there. And I also have on Pinterest, I have a page on Pinterest. Mm-hmm. And what I enjoy there is, you know, I'm not allowed to use a real celebrity on my covers or anything like that. But on Pinterest, I can do a book board and use my dream cast. And so, you know, I can post up there, you know, who I would, if I were making a movie, this is who I would have play Rudyard, you know. And so there, if you go to my Pinterest page, you can see my book boards, too, and who I had in my head when I was writing the story.
So everybody,
and also,
I want to thank.
I'm on Facebook too.
You're on
Facebook.
You got to friend me on Facebook. I have your review on Facebook.
I will.
I have your review on Facebook, and everybody's reading it. I just want everybody to know. Everybody reads everything I write. I got to be careful because you never know what I'm going to write. I don't post negative reviews ever. If a book doesn't get at least three and a half stars, I won't review it. I will just do a summary for the author, and I won't post it on Amazon because I don't believe that my opinion is my opinion, and I'm not going to do that. Also, let me make it very clear to everybody out there, I do not get paid to do book reviews ever. Someone sent me two books and a check, and I sent it back. because I don't get paid to do book reviews, and it's something that I just do because I want to do it, and I like doing what I'm doing. And the reason I'm doing it is because my sister, before she died, dared me to write a review of a cookbook, and I don't cook. And the review was so hysterical that the author made it go viral. So I have to thank Martha Cheeves, stir, laugh, and repeat. But I want to thank you so much for today. This was great, and I can't wait to get your next one.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been fun, and thank you so much for inviting me to be on your show and for reviewing the book. I will friend you on Facebook. And like I said, I have two Facebook pages. My author page is all my announcements. I mean, at any time I'm going to have I post my reviews, a lot of reviews up there. I post blog stops and stuff. So, I'm pretty much, I don't tweet, though. That's the one thing, I don't do a Twitter thing. I just can't wrap my head around Twitter, and I just don't get involved in it.
I use Twitter. The only thing I have to be honest on Twitter is I post your review. That's it. I don't make comments. I don't do anything. If Cheryl puts something from Partners in Crime or an author, you know, retweets my book, I'm going to retweet it. That's it. I don't make comments, and I don't get involved in discussions on Twitter either. I don't. I'm on LinkedIn, and I've got 2,500 and some odd people following me. I don't know why, but they do. And everybody reads my reviews, which is really great. So I want to thank you. Yeah, they do. They read yours. Let me tell you, there's a whole bunch of people on Facebook that said, I like the review. I said, then buy the book. That's my answer to everyone. If you like it, this was really original. I like this. As a matter of fact, I have the book in my hand, and my cousin and I are going out tomorrow, and she asked for the book. She wants it.
Oh, good.
Not only that, the people in my building call me the book girl. I supply everybody in the building with books. And even the porter in my building sends them to his country because they don't have books there. So I never have to worry. There's always people that want to read. So everybody have a great day. And it's cold outside, so get a nice hot cup of coffee, hot chocolate or tea. Sit down and read a book. Have a nice day, everybody. Thank you so much, and bye.
Bye.